You're listening to Soundforms, Conversations with Composers, with your host, Peter Wetzler. And this month, we're talking with my friend and colleague, John Hodian. John hails from Saugerties, Woodstock area, and is currently living in Berlin with his wife, Bette Williams, and their son, Jack. He's performing with his ensemble and Bette's ensemble and successfully making a living from touring Europe, which ain't easy, but at the moment, it's easier than trying to do the same here in New York. I first met John when he was working as the in-house composer in the bowels of ABC's Television Production Center on Columbus Avenue. And having scored literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of television episodes for the Disney-owned ABC, which includes Biography, History Channel, Discover, A&E, ABC News, and countless other subsidiaries, John saw the writing on the wall and got out of the scoring business while passing on some of his work to me. I stayed until the bitter end when ABC stopped using composers altogether and went entirely to library music. John went on to develop his talents as a composer and music director for his own productions, including the Epiphany Project, which we'll listen to after sampling some of his early minimalist work, and some hauntingly beautiful Armenian poems that he's set to music with a local Armenian group called the Nagash Ensemble. So let's start with some of the early work of John Hodian. This is from a 1980 album called Available Forms. Thank you. No, that's not Steve Reich, though certainly inspired by him. It's our guest on Soundforms this afternoon, the composer John Hodian. This is from his 1987 work called MMU 17 on the CD called Available Forms. Available Forms was recorded in Philadelphia before John moved to New York to pursue his Goring career and later his ensemble work, but I'll let John tell us about that. Let's go to the interview we recorded during his brief U.S. tour a couple of weeks ago. Actually, it was the day his ensemble, The Epiphany Project, performed at the Bearsville Theater in Woodstock.
Was Available Forms your first CD?
It was, yeah.
So, and that was very minimalist.
Very minimalist. I think very obviously influenced by Steve Reich. But then I do feel like it stands on its own, because I think it kind of took that language and went somewhere else with it. I mean, Steve, I went to school at the same time you did, probably, where it was a lot of really academic stuff. And it was Stockhausen and Boulez and Milton Babbitt, and I had a teacher who I won't name, very famous teacher, but every time I would do more than two eighth notes in a row, or anything that had any kind of reference to a tonal center, he would say, he spoke in a thick accent, so he was like, "Why are you writing like baby? You're not baby." You could not be tonal, you could not be rhythmic without being an idiot in his mind.
Yeah.
I mean, it had to be very extreme. So in the middle of that, I hear that there's some composers going to present his stuff. This was at Temple University. And I didn't know who it was.
No, it was Steve Reich.
Steve Reich playing a pre-release tape of a piece he was working on then, a rehearsal tape of a piece called, for now I'm calling it, Music for 18 Musicians. Uh-huh. He sat and he played this thing, which lasted 45 minutes, and it blew my mind. Totally. And so I met him, and again, there was this whole world now that, like, hooray, I don't have to be some new music creep. There's these other guys that are doing stuff that's, like, really, really great. And then, again, I don't know what you went through at Princeton, but I went through a tremendous amount of antagonism.
Yeah.
So, but there was this tremendous, those guys hated Steve Reich and Phil Glass. I mean, you just didn't play that stuff at that time. Now it seems like such a joke. I mean, to have that attitude, all those walls have so broken down. It's such a different world we live in. People in music school now can't imagine what it was like, you know, 30 or 40 years ago. Serialization, which is, you know, the 12-tone row applied to every aspect of music, you know, rhythm, timbre, dynamics. That was the new way to write. That was what you did. And that's just stupid beyond belief. I mean, it's interesting. It's fun for a day. It's a good, challenging thing. But I remember spending entire years, just counting tone rows and stuff. And once you dig into that stuff wholeheartedly, you can like it. You like it. It grows on you. Certain things grow on you. I mean, I used to love Weber, and I remember when the Boulez conducting Weber really took me there for a little while. Yeah. But if that's all the music was, then, you know, I don't know.
Did you listen to George Santakis' music?
Only a little bit. I don't know him that well.
Because he's the bard now. Right. He's the composer in residence of Bard. I heard a piece of his that started out minimalist, and it was absolutely beautiful. Mm-hmm. But then when I interviewed him here, we got into a big tussle about minimalism, because he said, I use minimalism like a fabric, you know, but I learned to modulate, or something like that. I learned to go somewhere. Very dismissive of the whole minimalist thing. But
well, composers, I mean, it's composers talking about other composers, it's usually not pretty. And it's okay. I mean, I think to be a composer, you have to be convinced that, you have to really believe that what you're doing is the only thing that's worth doing. And you become naturally dismissive of other people's things.
Yeah.
I want to break out of the interview here to play you a cut from Hin Dagh. That's HINDAGH. It's an artfully produced CD which comes in a hardcover book with beautifully designed pages of Armenian poetry, drawings, and pictures. This is John Hodian's Epiphany Project, which features his wife Bet Williams' spot-on vocals, as well as guest singers and instrumentalists ranging from Dumbek to Saz.
Markayı dağlardan Mangoni wangu umunilikuwa jana goingi katika damu tamaki. Leo sana nasikitika, hadumu rafiki. Yangu, yangu ucha.
That was Bette Williams singing Ujamu Yangu from the album Hindagh, spelled H-I-N-D-A-G-H, by the Epiphany Project, a collaboration between Bette and her husband John Hodian, our guest today on Soundforms. Kane Mathis played the kora on that, and Itu Hartuyunian played frame drum and shells, and John Hodian played all the other instruments. Before that, from the same album, was Ararat, Artu's song. And moving along with my disastrous pronunciation of names, we heard Arto Tungsboyachian, vocal intro, Ohannes Garabed Hoyadayan, playing santur, Scott Bricklin, bass, Tigran Suchian, trumpet, Ashot Harutunian, trombone, Arman Hustrentis, saxophone, and our guest John Hodian on piano, udu, and other percussion, and of course his wife Bette Williams on vocals. Back to John Hodian speaking a couple of weeks ago in my studio.
I really like touring just piano and drums and percussion and voice. Because that gives
No bass.
Gives me a tremendous amount of freedom. It's great because I can go anywhere harmonically and not worry about somebody
following.
Yeah, the
bass player being somewhere else.
Great. and it gives the drummer lots of room, and it gives me lots of room. Yeah. And it's because I think we've been on the road for so long, and because we've done so many live shows now, and especially with this particular drummer that we've been playing with, it just feels great. And it's a very fluid, loose thing. And like I said, the songs are specific melodies and chords, but we really approach it like a jazzer, but then we can really go out at any moment, and Bette can go with us.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And like I said, even if it screws up, I don't care. I mean, as an audience member, I'd rather be knowing that somebody was really trying, even if they fail, but just looking for something divine, you know, really digging in and trying to do something real than just, oh, we really rehearse this. We never, ever, ever rehearse. When there's something new, I might go over it, you know, Bette and I will work it out.
Yeah.
But usually Bette and I kind of write it together, so we know it. So it's just a question of communicating it to Mal.
Yeah.
But then once we you know, we might look at something in a sound check when it's brand new, but then we never rehearse anything.
Yeah, with the Rapidos, whenever we get invited to play a formal gig, like when we opened the Baltimore Jazz Festival, we got called Jazz one year.
Oh, yeah.
So all of a sudden we spent a week practicing, but practicing for what?
Yeah.
We're always improvising.
Yeah.
We never said anything. So the practice consisted of improvising And we go, yeah, that was really good. Let's try to do that. And then, of course, we would never do that. And yeah. It was just...
I remember reading something that Paul Blay said, and he said, you know, you become good at doing something by doing it. So if you're going to practice your instrument, you'll just be a good practicer. That doesn't mean you're going to be a good performer. If you want to be a good improviser, again, you can do that, but if you're doing it in your room, you're probably only going to be good in your room. Improvising in front of an audience is a totally different thing.
Yeah.
And you can only do that after you've done it, you know, a lot. It's like anything else. You just do it a lot and you get
good. Yeah. So, I mean, you're Armenian, so did you grow up with Armenian music? Or?
I did. Actually, you know, growing up, it's kind of the only thing we had in our house. So it was, until I was, whatever, 10 or 12, that was like literally all I heard. And then you'd go to a wedding, an Armenian wedding, and it'd be an Armenian band. Armenians were very close-knit, even in this country.
Yeah.
So I was never all that... Now, some kids learn Armenian. I didn't speak Armenian. Some of them only go to, like, an Armenian school. And I was not that Armenian. but culturally, I always loved the music and loved the food and everything. And it was a big part of my... what I grew up with. I mean, it's kind of very modal, a lot of asymmetrical meters, all that stuff. And all that stuff always would seep its way into my music. So there was that. But then I started studying classical piano, so you have this kind of classical repertoire as well. But then being an American, of course, you're always just surrounded by pop music. You just can't avoid it. So there's all that stuff. Then being in Philadelphia has its own thing, of that sound of Philadelphia and funk stuff. And so there's a lot of different... And then spent many years doing jazz stuff, so there's a lot of influences that I think come together. But then the more formal stuff, you're asking about this new project I have, the Nagash Ensemble. That is, everything's written out in that. That's a totally different thing. I'd been performing so much with the Epiphany Project and also with Bette's band. Bette has her own band. Which is a little more rock and roll, and we kind of are on the road with either one of those things a lot. So for years, I wasn't really writing other than tunes or material for either her band or for Epiphany Project. When I was living in New York, this Armenian guy contacted me. He had heard my music on the radio or something for, I think, John Schaefer's show. And because I was Armenian, he contacted me and said, I really loved what I heard. I'd like to meet you sometime. So I meet with this guy. And again, I liked Armenian culture, and I was proud of being Armenian, but it wasn't a thing for me. I wasn't a big nationalist or anything. Well, this guy is. This guy spends a lot of time going back and forth to Armenia. He had built this art center there, and he's really one of the most charismatic and just a wonderful, wonderful human being. So he takes me out to dinner. And over the course of a bottle of wine, or maybe two, starts telling me, you know, you should really come to Armenia. Yeah, I'd love to. That'd be great. Okay, next Thursday, I'll get the tickets, and we'll. I have a family, and I have a child to support. Okay, we'll make it the Thursday after. So anyway, he talks me into going there. I ended up bringing my wife and my son, who was only like 9 months at that point. I go to Armenia. And I really fell in love with the place because it's not America and it's not Europe and it's not the Middle East either. It's really, it's its own thing. I mean, it's a Christian nation in the middle of a bunch of Muslim nations. Now, I'm not talking about that from a religious perspective, but culturally, it just makes it a very unique thing. And it's very cosmopolitan. Yerevan's a very almost European city in its mentality. But it's also, like I said, it's got this Middle Eastern thing going on. It's really this odd mix of things. And I really fell in love with it, and fell in love with the people, and fell in love with the work he was doing. You know, it's a very impoverished country. It's a third world country, corrupt government, just kind of the worst of the worst. Landlocked, no resources, very poor. And yet it's got the highest literacy rate in the world, or tied with Israel, basically. Really pride themselves on their education. The arts are very important. All the streets in Yerevan are named after either poets or composers or architects or something. It's just amazing. But with the breakup of the Soviet Union, everything went to hell. I mean, there was now, they used to have a phenomenal conservatory there that was churning out great composers and conductors and musicians, and now there's hardly even a working toilet in the place. I mean, it's really, really horrible what's happened. So guys like this, who's a diasporan Armenian, some of them have gone back and they're trying to rebuild things. He started this thing called the Natagatsi Art Institute. I went there, they were doing this art exhibit for kids that was showing work that was related to the Armenian genocide. And I just thought it was really beautiful. And I said, well, this, his name's Nadeg, the guy who runs this. I said, Nadeg, God, what are you doing? There's nothing really for composers like this. He said, yeah, I know, well, you'll do that. And I was like, okay, that's like, I'm only in Armenia for a day. Yeah. So I stay up all night thinking about, well, what could you do for composers? You know, cause I looked into what the conservatory was doing and what was, I ended up spending years there and kind of did this competition for young composers that was very engrossing and time-consuming. Ended up building a recording studio there and doing some teaching there, and just fell in love with the music and the culture. I mean, because again, it was my music and my culture, but to be doing it from the genuine standpoint of being there, not just listening to it on an exotic record or something. So now we go back two or three times a year. About 5 years ago, I'm telling this story because of this Nagash ensemble. One of my favorite things to do in Armenia is to get outside of Yerevan, because the minute you get outside of Yerevan, there's almost nothing. Like I said, it's a very poor country, very, very rural. And we would go out, and you can explore some of these ancient monasteries and churches that are abandoned, but some of them have amazing acoustics that are just phenomenal. Walking around there with Bet and my son, and suddenly we hear these voices, this singing, that's just like amazing. It's just like this polyphonic singing that, like, what the hell is this? Are they pumping in music? But there's nobody else around. So we look around, it's these five women that go there to rehearse, and they sing only a traditional medieval Armenian spiritual music. And it's just beautiful. So I just sat there listening for like an hour. And like most beautiful things that I see, I wanted to steal it. And then they heard some Epiphany Project stuff and said, oh, well, you should write a piece for us. It's like, wow. And that was, I was consumed with doing this for years. Yeah. And I had to find the right text, however. Mm-hmm. And I spent years and years looking for the right text. And I finally found something. I mean, I read like everything that had been translated into English, all sorts of Armenian poetry, and spoke to a lot of Armenian writers and blah, blah, blah. And they had some ideas. Nothing was right. Finally, in this huge, there's this three-volume set of Armenian literature, and there's this, these two little sentence fragments attributed to this poet, Bukadish Nagash, who nobody knows anything about. But they were beautiful. They were just drop-dead beautiful. And I said, well, there's got to be more of this stuff. And nobody really knew about him. So I did a lot of research. Anyway, it turns out that there were 17 poems that still exist by this poet. And they are all beautiful to me. Mm. And they're all about what they call the Garib, or somebody who's a wanderer. And which is very integral to Armenian identity, because the nation's been so whittled down to nothing that basically nobody lives in what was Armenia anymore. We're all outside of our homeland. And these poems are all about dying outside of your homeland, being forced to leave your homeland and ending up never going back, never seeing your family again. But they're beautiful. They're really just transcendently beautiful. So this was my text. And I set it for these five female vocalists and string quartet and a handful of Armenian instruments, duduk and oud and dol.
That's what I saw on the YouTube. Right?
Yes.
Yeah.
It turns out that that's just a great, great combination of things for me. It's just, so now it's become a band, the Nagash Ensemble, which is in Armenia. We're bringing them to Europe in 2013. I'm trying to bring them to America in 2014, but that's gonna be really hard. It's a little easier to do it in Europe. But for me, it's a great, great ensemble, because you have these five female vocalists. And so instead of doing like overdubs like I would do in a studio with Ben, you have all five people and you can kind of write everything out for them. And then you have this string quartet, which is such a wonderfully flexible, delicious medium to work with. But then having a dumbeg and an oud, or an oud and a duduk on top of it, it's just, for me, it has everything I need as an ensemble. So I've set all 17 of these poems now. And it's this like almost 2-hour thing. So we did the premiere of it in Armenia in October, of part of it. I went back and re-recorded the final part of it just recently.
Christ.
And that was the Nagash Ensemble from Armenia performing text of the Armenian poet Nagash, set to music by our guest this afternoon, John Hodian. This recording is not yet available, but if you Google Nagash Ensemble, N-A-G-A-S-H, you'll find it on YouTube. And you can visit their website, www.the-nagash-ensemble.com. And also epiphanyrecords.com to purchase the CD when it becomes available. Actually, in order to squeeze the rest of the Nagash Ensemble recording in this hour, we'll just return to John for a minute talking about a software tool called Melodyne that's actually quite remarkable in that it allows you to fix the pitch of an off-key singer or instrument. And even more remarkably, it now allows you to go into a chord that, say, has one bad note in it, and either remove or raise or lower the clinker without altering the rest of the notes in the chord. So back to our conversation.
Have you tried Melodyne?
Yes.
Have you moved?
Not with my wife, singer, Beck, because she genuinely does not need it. She's like the most on top of it vocalist I've ever worked with in a studio. But this piece, this Nagash Ensemble thing we recorded in Armenia, with women, these five women who each have a different set of attitudes towards pitch, I guess. I'm trying to phrase this in a way that's... Anyway, I got to know Melodyne very well.
But no, the new thing where you can go inside a chord within and move chord, one note,
it is amazing.
It's so...
And what's amazing is the absence of artifact. I mean, some people say, oh, no, it's not... I don't hear anything. I mean, maybe it's just my ears, but I ran entire things through Melodyne, and I thought it sounded totally fine.
Yeah.
Oh, Thank you.
And that was the second cut of Songs of Exile, a yet-to-be-released CD of the Nagash Ensemble, composed by our guest this afternoon, John Hodian. And I know John would like me to feature more of the music of the Epiphany Project, but I'm going to urge you all to buy the CDs and MP3s online from epiphanyrecords.com. That's E-P-I-P-H-A-N-Y records.com. And I want to take us to the end of the hour with early Hodian. This work is from the Available Form CD, and it's called Work in Progress. And it combines the polyrhythmic motivic repetition of the minimalist form with improvised lines. And I particularly like hearing the twangy sound of my old friend, the Yamaha DX7 synthesizer. There seems to be now a resurgence of interest in the music of this time, which I'll be speaking about in more depth with Laurie Spiegel, the electronic and computer music pioneer, and also the co-inventor of algorithmic composition. And we'll talk more about that next month. You've been listening to Sound Forms Conversations with Composers, this month featuring Woodstock resident John Hodian, who's headed back with his family to their new home base in Berlin. I'm your host, Peter Wetzler, and next month we'll be featuring Conversations with and the music of Laurie Spiegel. Diamonds, so that I'm